KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Israel says Iran violated the new ceasefire deal. Iran denies it. We speak with the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Jim Himes, about what comes next. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump said he'd send 30,000 migrants to Guantanamo. He sent 500 so far. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It's costing the government $100,000 a day to hold someone there, far higher than detention in the U.S. Also, Carol Mosley Braun, the first African-American woman elected to the Senate, among other firsts. She shares the high cost of being a trailblazer. It is Tuesday, June 24th. 3 years ago today, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, ending the nationwide right to an abortion. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says both Iran and Israel have broken a newly declared ceasefire. Speaking to reporters earlier today, Trump used an epithet to say both countries have been fighting so long they don't know what they're doing. Iran has denied Israel's claim of an Iranian missile attack. NPR's Daniel Estrin says Israel's leader says the country responded militarily.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke with Trump, and Israeli jets carried out a small strike on Iranian radar. But Trump said online, Israel will not strike Iran, and he said the ceasefire is in effect. Remarkable comments from Trump, directing anger at Israel. We'll have to see if this completely unravels the ceasefire or not.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting. Separately, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu says that after he spoke with President Trump, Israel has now refrained from further attacks. The president is flying toward the Netherlands at this hour. He'll attend the NATO summit being held in The Hague. European leaders are also calling on Israel and Iran to return to the negotiating table, as NPR's Rob Schmitz reports.
German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said Israel and Europe, as well as the rest of the world, are threatened by Iran's nuclear program. He said he hopes actions by the U.S. and Israel in Iran will permanently dissuade Tehran from pursuing its goals for nuclear weapons. He delivered the remarks in an address to the German parliament before heading to the NATO summit in The Hague. Meanwhile, the European Union called on Iran to engage seriously in a credible diplomatic process, adding that the escalation benefits no one. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Earlier today, President Trump also criticized Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. Trump wants Powell to lower short-term interest rates. The Fed chair is testifying before the House of Representatives today as part of his twice-yearly briefings to Congress. In prepared remarks, Powell says the Fed will wait to see whether to cut rates. The U.S. Supreme Court says the Trump administration can continue to deport migrants to countries that are not their home nations. The court's ruling overturns a lower court's decision. NPR's Tobia Smith reports there have been objections.
The court did not explain its reasoning, but dissenting justices did, calling the order inexcusable. Attorney Anwin Hughes, who represented immigrants being sent to South Sudan, says thousands others may now have no chance to challenge deportations to countries where they risk torture, for example.
This administration, you know, don't really show mature judgment or concern for human life. And so we're extremely concerned that this pattern can have devastating consequences.
Trump administration officials say, quote, activist judges are putting Americans at risk by blocking deportations of violent criminals. The Department of Homeland Security calls the order a victory, posting fire up the deportation planes. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
You're listening to NPR. The National Weather Service says extreme heat warnings and heat advisories reach from the lower Mississippi Valley right up to Maine's border with Canada today. The service says nearly 160 million people are affected. Triple-digit temperatures are possible along the East Coast today. A new generation of obesity medicines is in the works. A study showing promising results for an experimental pill that works like the blockbusters Ozempic and Wegovy. NPR's Sydney Lepkin has more.
Eli Lilly is developing a pill called Orforglipron. In a study of patients with type 2 diabetes, it lowered blood sugar. Patients on the highest dose lost an average of 16 pounds. The results were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The study compared the experimental pills to placebo, followed more than 550 people, and lasted 40 weeks. Some patients experienced gastrointestinal issues when they increased their doses, but no episodes of low blood sugar called hypoglycemia. This was not a head-to-head study of Orforglipron compared to already approved injectable obesity drugs like Novo Nordisk's Wegovy, but the safety and effectiveness appeared to be similar. Eli Lilly says it plans to submit Orforglipron for regulatory approval for obesity by the end of the year. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
A private company in Japan says its space probe crashed on the moon earlier this month because a laser navigating it failed to work properly. The firm, iSpace, says the navigational tool did not measure the probe's distance correctly as it plunged toward the lunar surface. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. It has been a dizzying and confusing 12 days, and I'm just going to walk you through what's happened. First, Israel struck nuclear facilities inside Iran and killed top military officials and nuclear scientists, some in their homes. For days then, Iran and Israel traded fire and many people were killed. And then the U.S. got involved, carrying out strikes inside Iran, and Iran responded with strikes on a U.S. airbase in Qatar. And then suddenly, President Trump declared a ceasefire had been reached between Iran and Israel. But hours into the deal, it already seems to be falling apart. And to walk us through that, we're joined by senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Hey, Tam.
Hi.
So what's happening with this ceasefire?
Yeah, let me walk you through the timeline. Overnight, we got word that both Israel and Iran had agreed to the ceasefire. But right up to the time it was supposed to take effect, Israel intensified its strikes in Iran. And then, just as it should have been taking effect, Israel says Iran sent missiles in its direction, something Iranian state media is denying. Now Israel's defense minister says he has ordered a forceful response involving, quote, intense strikes against targets in the heart of Tehran. So it looks like the firing hasn't ceased, but, you know, the situation is often pretty dicey and uncertain at the start of any ceasefire.
And we just heard remarks from President Trump. He was angry. What did he say?
Yeah, he spoke this morning on the South Lawn of the White House. You can hear chopper noise behind him. And he said he is not happy with either of them.
I'm not happy with Israel. You know, when I say, okay, now you have 12 hours, you don't go out in the first hour and just drop everything you have on them. So I'm not happy with them. I'm not happy with Iran either. But I'm really unhappy if Israel's going out this morning because the one rocket that didn't land, that were shot, perhaps by mistake, that didn't land.
He said he was going to see if he could do something to stop it. Then he got on Marine One and posted on Truth Social, "Israel, do not drop those bombs. If you do, it is a major violation. Bring your pilots home now." And I do want to draw attention to one other thing he said, which really illustrates his anger at this moment. I have never seen a U.S. president use the F word on camera, ever. And yet President Trump did, saying, quote, "We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the blank they're doing."
Okay, Tam, so not surprising to hear President Trump use harsh language when referring to Iran, but as you said, extremely unusual for a president to use the F word on camera. But these are some strong words he has for Israel, a U.S. ally.
Yeah, you know, President Trump often has stronger words for U.S. allies than he does for traditional U.S. enemies. And in this case, he just seems to be disappointed with the way this is unfolded.
Tam, how did the president go from ordering strikes on nuclear facilities inside Iran just a few days ago to then demanding peace and brokering a ceasefire between Israel and Iran?
He actually demanded peace in that very first Truth Social post on Saturday night announcing the U.S. strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities. And at the time, it seemed like wishful thinking. But if this ceasefire holds, and that is a really big if, it fits with Trump's mantra of peace through strength. A lot of his supporters didn't want the president to get the U.S. involved in Israel's conflict with Iran. It's been a difficult few days for the Trump base. But at this moment, it looks like he may have found a way for this to be a one-and-done strike and not a wider war. But again, a lot is in flux.
NPR's Tamara Key. Thank you, Tam.
You're welcome.
Let's go to a top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee now. That's Congressman Jim Hines of Connecticut. He's part of the Gang of Eight. That's the small group of lawmakers typically briefed on sensitive national security matters, and he's the ranking Democrat on that committee. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the ceasefire seems to have fallen apart at the moment. The president said this morning that both Israel and Iran violated it. Do you have any sense of what's next?
Well, I'm not sure anybody has a sense of what's next. It does seem like in these first couple of days of conflict, we have avoided the, you know, 20 or 30 worst case scenarios that usually accompany a war in the Middle East. We're not seeing gas prices spike. We're not seeing fatalities or casualties of American troops. I mean, you can just spin out the many, many scenarios, which thank God we've managed to avoid. But of course, this is a day-to-day thing. And it also, at some point, we've got to ask the question of, given the immense gamble that was taken here, both by Israel and by the President of the United States, I would point out, without consultation of the United States Congress, as required by law, what was actually achieved? I have seen absolutely no evidence to back up the Vice President's statement that the Iranian nuclear program was obliterated. In fact, I would be very, very surprised if that was in fact true. So the question obviously remains, if the Iranian nuclear program was set back in a very small way, which I think, you know, we'll see, but that's certainly a possibility, all of this risk and this massive gamble will have been undertaken for a tiny marginal improvement at best. And if that turns out to be the case, the question, of course, is what's next? What do the Israelis do? How do we feel about it?
So who in the U.S. government is trying to get to the bottom of what was actually accomplished in those strikes? And do you have any confidence that whoever is sort of tasked with this will report to you and other members of Congress?
The extensive apparatus of the intelligence community, and as you might imagine, that involves everything from satellites to the ability to conduct espionage against the nation of Iran, traditional espionage, I do think that we will have a pretty good sense in the coming days and weeks of what was actually achieved in Iran. Though I want to be careful about talking about anything that could be classified, yes, I do think that that is of such importance, given the gamble that was taken here, that we will get a pretty good estimate of what occurred. In fact, without getting into details, I will tell you that when I was at the Capitol yesterday, we were already beginning to see some very preliminary indications of what may or may not have been achieved.
I want to go back to this question of oversight that you raised. You've said that you learned about the U.S. strikes on Iran through social media. Is there a path toward getting more oversight moving forward?
Well, in my many years of experience serving on the Intelligence Committee, I will tell you that this administration has been uniquely bad about responding to the constitutionally mandated jobs of oversight that we do. You know, I everything from SignalGate to the apparent pressure to change the report inside the intelligence community on Tren de Aragua that famously contradicted the president. We've asked all sorts of questions and gotten very, very few answers. As you point out, my Republican counterpart, Rick Crawford, the chairman of the committee, was informed prior to the raid, but I, the Democrat, was not. And so we're seeing sort of almost disdain from this administration with respect to that oversight. And when the stakes are as high as they are right now, and, you know, we're talking about the possibility of war in the Middle East, that's just not, it's never okay, but particularly when the stakes are this high.
So my question to you is, what recourse do you and other Democrats have? You make the argument that this isn't just a custom, that this is required. So then the question becomes, how do you enforce that going forward?
There's not a good answer to that question, because the Democratic Party, the party in which I am a member, is in the minority. And to date, the Republican majority, which has subpoena power, which has the ability to move bills to the floor, which has the ability to hold administration officials in contempt, has shown precisely zero interest in doing that. Now, the dissatisfying but honest answer to your question is that if the Democrats are able to take the majority and therefore in 18 months have subpoena power, have all of those tools at our disposal, at that point, I think, we'll have options other than simply making the case to the American people that, you know, shutting down oversight and ignoring the rules is not okay.
You co-introduced a war powers resolution that would remove U.S. armed forces from hostilities against Iran without approval from Congress. We had heard that there were some Republicans who were not pleased with the level of consultation with Congress. Do you have any sense that this might have enough support to go forward?
We're certainly going to take a crack at it, and we're hoping against hope that maybe there are a handful of Republicans who will remember that their duty is to the Constitution, to which they raised their right hand and took an oath, as opposed to the man that occupies the Oval Office.
That is Congressman Jim Himes of Connecticut. He is a Democrat. He's the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee and part of the so-called Gang of Eight. Congressman Himes, thank you so much for talking with us once again.
Thanks for having me.
If you're listening anywhere from Nebraska to New Jersey, you don't need me to tell you that it is hot outside. A heat wave is smothering much of the country in temperatures that feel warmer than 100 degrees.
And with many kids out of school for the summer, we wanted to know if it's too hot for them to be outside.
It is up to adults to use their common sense. But we do worry about temperatures outside being above 95 degrees.
That's Dr. Jess Weiss. She's a pediatrician at Children's National Hospital here in Washington, D.C. She says there are ways to keep kids safe outside.
Taking lots of breaks, especially if they're being physically active, drinking a lot of water, also using sun protection, so that may be a hat that should be sunscreen.
Weiss says there's one big reason we need to pay attention to children in the heat.
Honestly, kids are more likely to play than to be disciplined enough to take breaks. So some of that is where your parenting has to come in and the adults and caregivers have to come in.
For those running summer camp or daycares, Dr. Weiss has this advice.
Keeping outdoor time outside of those really hot hours, so between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m., they're able to do more outdoor activity first thing in the morning or in the later afternoon when it's less hot, can be safer.
That's exactly what's happening this week at Curiosity Preschool and Child Care Center in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Is there any dog walker, please?
Of course, you can help them.
The center's director is Javeria Royal. She says they've tweaked the kids' schedule.
So our outdoor activities, I move them in the morning. All our children, you know, they are well hydrated. As a teacher, I have to constantly remind them, like, hey, you know, your body is like an engine. It can overheat, so you need to fuel yourself with water.
Mila Zudik is a student there. She is 5 years old. The heat has her missing her outdoor playtime.
I like to go on slides outside, and I also like to go to the parks.
Sorry, Mila, you might have to wait a little longer. This heat wave is expected to last into next week. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll discuss the regime of Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the history of Iran's nuclear weapons program, and the possible outcomes in the region following the U.S.'s bombing of Iran's facilities. Our guest will be Karim Sajidpour, a policy analyst at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I hope you can join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. If Carol Moseley Braun's name comes up, the other word that has to come up is first. She was the first African-American woman elected to the U.S. Senate. She was also the first female senator from Illinois and the first black Democrat elected to the Senate. And while all those titles assured her place in the history books, they didn't assure an easy time in the job. And they certainly don't tell the story of the highs and the high cost of being the first. So Carol Moseley Braun is doing that herself in her new memoir titled Trailblazer: Perseverance in Life and Politics. And she's with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Ambassador. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I'm so delighted to be with you. Good to talk to you again.
And it's Ambassador Moseley Braun because in addition to having been a U.S. Senator and a number of other offices in politics, you were also U.S. Ambassador to New Zealand and Samoa. So you've been out of public life for a while. What made you want to tell your story now? Was there any particular thing pushing you?
You know, my little grandbaby, he's 7 now. He came and said, "Grandma Carol, are you famous?" And I tried to explain it to him, but, you know, it's too many words, and he was only 6 at the time. So I said, you know what, I think that now is the time.
Why did you decide to get into elected office to begin with? Will you tell that story?
I've been assistant United States attorney, and I had my son. And so I was here with him. I was just doing it, being a homemaker, which was fine. I really enjoyed it. But there were people in the neighborhood who were protesting the removal of the bobolinks from Jackson Park. And I joined them one day, and the bobolinks are these little rice birds, originally from South Carolina, but somehow or another they wound up here in Chicago, okay? And so some of the people with whom I was marching said, "We think you should run for state representative. Our state representative is retiring." So at first I demurred and wouldn't do it. But then after I got challenged, there's a pundit here in Chicago who said, "Don't run, you can't possibly win. The blacks won't vote for you because you're not part of the Chicago machine. The whites won't vote for you because you're black. And nobody's going to vote for you because you're a woman." So, and so that was my inspiration. That's what did it.
And nobody thought you could win except you.
Nobody thought I could win. She lost all of her mind. Yeah.
But one of the things that was also interesting in the book is that so many of the jobs that you had, there was a point at which nobody believed it was you actually had that job. I mean, you tell the story
right.
about like being an assistant U.S. attorney and coming home from one of those cold Chicago winters, trying to get home, and you're trying to hail a taxi. This is pre-Uber, of course.
Yep.
And this police officer keeps riding by you saying, what was he saying? Get off that corner.
Give up that corner.
And he thought you were
a hooker.
Because what? Why else would a black woman dressed up?
Because I was a black woman standing on the corner in downtown Chicago.
And then you talked about your first day at the Senate when you tried to get to your office. There was a Capitol police officer who
wouldn't let me in.
Wouldn't let
exactly.
you in.
Well, there are always two Capitol police standing on the doors to the Senate. The first guy, he said, "You can't go in there." I said, I looked at him like quizzically, like, "Why? Why can't I?" Then the other guy piped in and said, "Oh, she's the new senator from Illinois." And so that backed his colleague off.
I don't want people to think that the entire memoir is just filled with these insults directed at you, although there were many, like, for example, the senator who would
sing Dixie in your presence and so forth. Right. And so there's that. And but there were some structural issues that you also pointed out that made your job more difficult than for other people, include, like, for example, the amount of mail that you got. Could you talk about that?
The mail was really a challenge because there was so much of it. I mean, they gave me a room in the basement of the Capitol that was filled with these duffel bags full of mail. There was no way I could possibly do all of that by myself. And so I went to leadership and I asked for assignment of some help. And one guy said to me, well, Ted Kennedy gets a lot of mail and, you know, he handles it. I'm thinking, you're telling me I got to function like Ted Kennedy does? I was too outdone.
But they never gave you additional staff just to deal with
the
mail.
No, they did not.
And do you think that played some role over the course of your tenure, the kind of angst that's sometimes built up around you, that people felt that you weren't doing the job?
It might have. But, again, you can't make everybody happy. But if you do the job, then people can't take pot shots at you.
Well, they did, though.
Yeah, they did.
Why do you think you served only one term?
Because of that. You know, there was such expectations, and people expected me to come to every chicken fry in the state, and I couldn't do it. You know, I did as much as I could, but I couldn't do all of it.
Do you think that's why? I mean, you think that at the end of the day, the expectations of you were just greater than you could as one person fulfill?
That's part of it, but I think it's also what standard you're being held to. Again, I was kind of the duckbill platypus of the Senate in the sense that I was not only a woman, but I was black too. And I am black too. And so you put those things together and what you have is a set of expectations that border on the unreasonable, that border on the trailblazing, the groundbreaking, if you will. And so I did my very best to live up to those expectations, but it was not always possible.
Is there anything you wish you'd done differently?
Well, not really. I did the best job I could while I was planted. I really did. And I still am. I mean, I'm not dead yet. It's like, I spoke at a high school, at a grammar school rather, and the school was named after me. And one little boy said, hey, there goes Carol Moseley Braun. And his little friend turned around and said, you mean she's not dead yet? No, she's not dead yet. So I'm still here. So while I'm still here and able to tell the story, that's why the book made sense to do.
Well, one of the things about being first is it often makes things easier for people who are next, right?
Follow.
The second,
yes.
And the third and the fourth. Is there something in particular that you think made it easier for them by the fact that you went first?
Well, I hope the fact that I deflected all of the brickbats, that I don't think anybody's going to be held to the same kind of standard I was being held to in terms of, you know, production. I hope that has really provided a roadmap to people who come afterwards. Don't get distracted with all the noise around you, because there will be lots of noise around you. But if you don't let that distract you and you just keep focusing on what the people elected you to do, you'll be fine.
That is Ambassador Carol Moseley Braun. She's the author of Trailblazer, Perseverance in Life and Politics. Ambassador Moseley Braun, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm so happy to talk to you again, Michelle.
This is NPR News.
It's been 3 years since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Since then, doctors have become more supportive of self-managed abortion with pills.
Now the healthcare profession is saying, wait, does that person really need to come in to do that ultrasound? Lo and behold, there's all this evidence already out there that no, they don't.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump insists the ceasefire between Israel and Iran is in effect, despite Trump saying both countries violated the agreement in the early hours of the deal. Speaking to reporters outside the White House this morning, the president criticized both countries for not adhering to the agreement. Israel says it responded militarily after Iran fired missiles into northern Israel. State media in Tehran denied the violation. Trump later said Israel was calling back its planes. Trump is on his way to the Netherlands for a NATO summit. NATO's Secretary General is offering reassurances to members of the alliance as this week's two-day summit gets underway in The Hague.
There is total commitment by the U.S. president and the U.S. senior leadership to NATO. However, it comes with an expectation. And the expectation is that we will finally deal with this huge pebble in the shoe, this huge irritant, which is that we are not spending enough as Europeans and Canadians.
Mark Rutte was speaking in The Hague, where NATO countries are expected to announce a boost in military spending. President Trump addresses the summit tomorrow. En route, Trump dismissed the idea of the U.S. meeting NATO's expected new target of 5% of GDP. Despite a shaky start to the ceasefire between Israel and Iran, oil prices are lower. This is NPR News. Federal investigators are meeting today to consider what caused a door plug panel to blow off a Boeing 737 MAX jet last year. Nobody aboard the Alaska Airlines flight was seriously injured when the door plug came off minutes after takeoff from Portland, Oregon. But NPR's Joel Rose says the incident raises serious safety questions.
The National Transportation Safety Board will hear the final results of an investigation into what caused the midair blowout in January of 2024. The NTSB has previously said that four bolts that were supposed to hold the door plug panel in place were missing when the Boeing 737 MAX jet was delivered to Alaska Airlines the previous year. But the board has not revealed exactly who was responsible. The board members are expected to vote on the probable cause of the incident. Boeing has since replaced its CEO and top managers of its 737 MAX line and has only recently returned to the production rate that it was planning before the door plug blowout. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Authorities in California say divers have recovered the body of an eighth person who died when a boat capsized over the weekend during stormy weather. High waves toppled the 27-foot boat. The National Weather Service is warning of extreme heat today in the eastern third of the U.S. from eastern Texas to Maine. Some areas could see afternoon highs of 100 degrees. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Earlier this year, President Trump said he would send up to 30,000 migrants to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Skeptics predicted he would face major hurdles in carrying out that plan, lack of bed space, high cost, and the complicated logistics of flying all these people to a Caribbean island. Now, NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer has an update. Sasha, good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
So, do we know how many migrants have actually been sent to Guantanamo?
The government is sharing very few numbers publicly. In fact, I sent the Department of Homeland Security a list of 13 questions about this, and all I got in reply was a brief email saying, this story is fake news. However, we are getting glimpses into what's happening there from a congressional delegation that recently toured Guantanamo. They were told about 400 migrants had been sent in and out of there as of March, and according to a court filing this month, that number has increased to about 500. The delegates were also told Guantanamo only has capacity for about 200 migrants at a time, nowhere near 30,000. Democratic Michigan Senator Gary Peters was on that tour, and here he is at a congressional hearing in May.
It's costing about $100,000 a day to keep someone at Guantanamo Bay. When we fly them down there, we keep them there a while, then we fly them back to the United States. Man, this is like ripe for Doge. Why is Doge not down there?
Layla, Senator Peters also noted that keeping migrants in ICE detention in the U.S. only costs about $165 a day. And he said the total bill for sending migrants to Guantanamo for just the first 2 months of this operation was about $40 million.
Okay, that's a lot of money, but I want to go back to something else he said about migrants being flown to Guantanamo and then flown back to the United States. Why is that happening?
The government has not explained its rationale for that. It said in a court filing that it's using Guantanamo for, quote, staging for final removal, but it gave no reason why Gitmo should be a pit stop before sending some migrants to their final deportation destination, or why it's briefly sending some of them to Gitmo only to return them to the U.S. Now, I spoke with an ACLU lawyer named Lee Gelernt, and he believes this is a fear campaign to encourage self-deportation.
There's no rational reason from a policy standpoint to send people to Guantanamo for a day, 2 days, even for a few weeks, unless your sole objective is to scare immigrants and create this theater.
Okay, he says it's a scare tactic, but were you able to speak to any Republican delegates who toured Guantanamo?
I contacted a half dozen Republicans who went on that trip, all declined to comment or didn't reply. But one did post a video of himself talking about the tour on his Instagram account. This is Congressman Mike Collins of Georgia.
Hey, listen, just got back from Guantanamo Bay. We got votes coming up here in just a few minutes. But I want to tell you something. I can't think of a better place than Gitmo to send these thugs, these rapists, these murderers, drug dealers, human traffickers that Joe Biden and the Democrats let flood into our country.
Now, we know from court records that many of the migrants sent to Guantanamo had no criminal records. But Congressman Collins said the U.S. should spend whatever it takes to accomplish President Trump's mission of securing our border. Overall, though, that initial skepticism that Guantanamo could hold 30,000 migrants appears to be justified so far.
That's NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer. Thank you so much for that really important reporting.
You're welcome.
For 6 weeks now, federal prosecutors have laid out their case against the producer and entrepreneur Sean Combs in a Manhattan courtroom. Today, Combs' defense lawyers will take over. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento has been in the courthouse, and she's with us now with a look at the defense case. And here's where I want to let you know that this report will include discussion about alleged sex trafficking. With that being said, good morning, Isabella.
Good morning, Michelle.
So what can we expect from Combs' lawyers?
Well, to start, we can expect it to be very, very brief. The prosecution took more than 6 weeks, but from what I understand, there's a chance the defense might be done by the end of today.
A single day? That seems fast. Do we know why that is?
Well, Combs' lead attorney, Mark Agnifilo, indicated to the judge that the defense will likely not be calling any witnesses. Compare that to the prosecution, which called more than two dozen witnesses. That included former assistants, law enforcement agents, and two ex-girlfriends who have accused Combs of sex trafficking. Prosecutors say Combs coerced them into drug-fueled sex marathons with male escorts that lasted multiple days. Combs has pleaded not guilty to all of the charges he faces. He's been in the courtroom every single day. His family is often there. He's been dressed very conservatively, and his hair and his beard have gone gray while he's in jail. So he's very present and engaged with his defense team. At one point, the judge reprimanded him for nodding at the jury while his lawyers cross-examined a government witness. But now we know he won't be taking the witness stand for the defense.
How did the defense handle cross-examination of the prosecution witnesses?
So when it comes to the two alleged sex trafficking victims, both of whom are ex-girlfriends of Combs, the defense has tried to cast doubt on the allegation that they were forced to participate in these nights. The The defense asked them to read a lot of text messages, suggesting they willingly participated in and even planned some of these encounters. They showed the jury explicit screen grabs and videos, and they suggested these women may have had different reasons other than coercion for agreeing to what the defense has called unconventional sex. The defense has also called the allegations against Combs part of a, quote, Me Too money grab. They got pretty confrontational with some of the witnesses, in particular with witnesses who seemed to be there to lend credibility to Cassie Ventura. She's the most well-known of the two accusers.
Okay, so let's just say this, that the defense does not seem to be contesting that these sexual encounters happened, what they're calling unconventional sex, what other people might call, you know, shocking and disturbing. So they're not defending his character.
Yeah, I mean, during opening arguments, defense attorney Tenney Garrigo said that Combs might come across as a jerk and that he's a really complicated man, but this is not a complicated case. So the defense admits that their client has been violent and he's a drug user, but they say none of this meets the burden of proof for what he's being charged with here. That includes not just sex trafficking, but racketeering conspiracy. Prosecutors say he ran a criminal organization to enable and conceal his bad behavior. But there is one way in which his character has become a part of the case, and it relates to his status in the city where he's being tried. Combs has a reputation as a very successful businessman and a major cultural figure in New York. The defense has taken a lot of opportunities to highlight the fact that many people admire him, even some of the witnesses that have testified against him.
So if this unfolds as you think it will today, the defense case will be brief. What's next?
So closing arguments are expected to begin on Thursday. Defense attorney Tenney Garrigo told the judge that the government and Combs' defense are estimating each side will need 4 hours. That's about 8 hours total. So closing arguments will likely go into Friday, and then the jury will be given instructions to begin deliberating. All of this means that we could have a verdict really soon.
That is NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento. Isabella, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Journalist Susie Hansen says Israel violated international humanitarian law during its war in Gaza and that the U.S. is complicit. She shares her findings next time on Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. No Stairway, denied. The record store from Wayne's World is closing next month. That's where Wayne, played by Mike Myers, pines after a Fender Strat. Castle's Music in San Fernando, California opened almost 80 years ago. It sold Richie Valens his first guitar in 1958. Its current owner says he isn't the biggest rock fan. He wants to see classical music on the Amalfi Coast in his retirement. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments, As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. President Trump says he's making government more accountable, going after bureaucrats who he says aren't doing their jobs.
We are stopping their gravy train, ending their power trip.
His administration wants to make it easier to say,
you're fired. Get the hell out of here. You're fired. Get out of here.
NPR labor and workplace correspondent Andrea Hsu reports.
When Erica Groshen was commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics back in the Obama administration, she gained a deep appreciation for the staff who calculate the unemployment rate, the rate of inflation, changes to wages. She affectionately calls them data nerds.
That's what they are. They are like the best data nerds around.
Their loyalty is to the numbers. It has to be, Groshen says, because their work drives decisions that are fundamental to our economy. The Federal Reserve uses their data when choosing to raise or lower interest rates. People's Social Security benefits are adjusted based on the Consumer Price Index, which the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out every month.
If the BLS makes a mistake in that of a tenth of a percentage point, then beneficiaries are going to be overpaid or underpaid by $1 billion.
Outside government, businesses tie their contracts to the inflation rate. They decide where to manufacture things based on wages. Groshen says the reason all this works is because Americans trust that the people who collect and process and report all the data are doing it free from political interference.
It's really critical to have that trust.
But now, Groshen fears, things could change. The Trump administration is expected to publish a final rule in the coming weeks, creating a new category of federal employees who serve at the pleasure of the president. The administration says some 50,000 jobs could be reclassified, those that are, quote, policy influencing. Groshen has no idea what that means.
It is not specific.
She doesn't think it should apply to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, but...
Does BLS influence policy? Yes, it's intended to.
And so she fears the data nerds could be caught up in this. Many federal workers across the government have told NPR they fear they're vulnerable too. The Trump administration did not answer NPR's questions about the new rule or who it will apply to, but it has made clear what the goals are. The administration says it's currently too hard to remove poor performers and those who defy the president's orders. Here's White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt.
If you work for the government, you should be adhering to the will of the American public and advancing the administration's goals and interests. And if you are not doing that, then you should go find another job whose interests you align with.
The new rule would make it easier for the administration to fire those seen as obstructing the president's goals. Don Kettle, former dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, says the problem with that is that being accountable isn't only about following presidential orders. It's about following the law.
And following the regulations and following the Constitution and following their professional judgment. And so things that may look to a supervisor like somebody slow walking or sabotaging may in fact be the legitimate effort of an employee to follow those other standards of accountability that are just as important.
Under the proposed rule, Trump himself will make the final call on who gets reclassified as an at-will employee. Erica Groshen is hoping he'll exclude all the statistical agencies because she says if there's even a perception that government data could be manipulated by politics,
the trustworthiness of the information would be lost.
And that would have huge implications for an economy that needs reliable data to stay on track. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On a Tuesday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. Mario Guevara, a journalist from El Salvador, has lived in the U.S. for 20 years. He reports on immigrant communities in Georgia for Spanish-language media outlets. He was even the subject of a 2019 New York Times documentary.
Turn off the camera.
Officer, you can do that, officer.
You're not here for any lawful purposes.
Earlier this month, Guevara was arrested while reporting on an anti-Trump protest in Atlanta. He was then transferred to immigration authorities and remains in detention. The Committee to Protect Journalists is expressing alarm. I asked Catherine Jacobson, CPJ's U.S., Canada, and Caribbean program coordinator, why.
Guevara was covering the No Kings protests against the Trump administration. He was wearing a press vest that clearly stated press on it and was live streaming the event. At the time of his detention, he was trying to record the proceedings and officers walked up to him and arrested him. I should also say this is all available on body cam footage, which has since been released. So there's very clear documentation about what happened.
So what is the Committee to Protect Journalists' concern here? I mean, was he detained over his legal status or was he detained because of his work?
Guevara was initially detained because he was recording a protest. There are misdemeanor charges against him. It's highly irregular that any of those charges would actually be held up, right? We've seen this in many other cases. And simply put, Guevara was doing his job and reporting the news. And to use that as a pretext to hold him, a journalist, for a very long period of time in law enforcement detention, and then to transfer him to ICE detention after that is something that we haven't seen before and is an incredibly alarming precedent to set.
What protections exist for immigrant journalists like Guevara and others who are doing their jobs in the United States?
Well, in theory, they enjoy the same First Amendment rights that a U.S. citizen who is a reporter enjoy while they're out covering things. In the U.S., there are hundreds of foreign reporters. Many of them have a specific type of journalist visa, but some have other types of work authorization. And when a journalist who, again, is here legally, is picked up by law enforcement and then his immigration status is called into question in the course of these legal proceedings, it's alarming.
So you sent a letter to the Department of Homeland Security. What did you say in that letter? What were you asking for and what did they say back?
We sent a letter to the Department of Homeland Security asking that Guevara be released immediately and pointed out that the whole reason why he was detained in the first place was because of charges relating to First Amendment activity, and we find that very problematic. We have not received a response. The Department of Homeland Security has also tweeted that the narrative about Guevara is false, so they have not specified further as to what the falsehoods are.
What would you say to other non-citizen journalists in the United States right now who have work authorization or visas to do their jobs, who may be afraid to cover sensitive issues or protests because of what they're seeing?
I think there is a great deal of reason for concern at this time, and it's important to make sure that those journalists have contact with a good immigration lawyer as well as First Amendment lawyers and have a clear understanding of their rights.
Catherine Jacobson is the U.S., Canada, and Caribbean Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We reached out to the Department of Homeland Security. They also told us this narrative is false. In a statement, a department spokesperson said Guevara is in removal proceedings and urged him to, quote, self-deport. They also said Guevara was arrested by local police and transferred to ICE custody because he entered the U.S. illegally in 2004. Guevara's lawyer says that's not true. He entered the country legally on a visa and that he has work authorization. The lawyer says his immigration status had been pending.
Federal regulators were ready to add more than a dozen more languages to the emergency alert system to increase access to vital information. But as NPR's Nick Peters reports, those additions have been delayed without explanation.
When the LA wildfires swept into neighborhoods earlier this year, emergency evacuation alerts were sent out to residents in English and Spanish. But UCLA researchers found more than 12,000 people in the wildfire zones didn't speak either language, mostly in Asian American and immigrant households. UCLA professor Paul Long was an author on that study. He says a lot of people didn't know what was going on.
Those households depended on their children to help them get information.
Ong says people in LA speak many different languages.
Among Asian Americans, we find literally dozens of languages spoken. And that speaks to the cultural diversity of this population.
The U.S. Census Bureau says nearly 68 million Americans speak a language other than English at home. Manju Kulkarni is with AAPI Equity Alliance, a nonprofit that serves Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders.
The language that any individual speaks really shouldn't keep them from receiving necessary information to keep their families safe.
The Federal Communications Commission voted to address this issue 2 years ago. The agency decided to add emergency alerts in 14 more languages, including Mandarin, Vietnamese, and Tagalog. That rule is set to go into effect this January, but it hasn't happened yet, and the commission hasn't said why. The FCC and the White House did not respond to several inquiries from NPR asking about the delay. Representative Nanette Barragan is a Democrat who represents South LA. She says the delay makes no sense, in part because current FCC Chairman Brendan Carr, a Trump appointee, backed the rule change 2 years ago when he was a commissioner.
The FCC has already voted, and the Chairman Carr supported this rule. There's only one step left. That step is to publish the report and order in the Federal Register.
Publishing in the Federal Register starts a 30-month clock for wireless providers to update their emergency alerts. Barragan and other advocates say the longer it is delayed, the more risk there is to immigrant communities during extreme weather events. Nate Perez, NPR News.
Later today, you'll hear about Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. She has a reputation for standing up to President Trump and his agenda. Take, for instance, Trump's big spending and tax bill.
I don't refer to it as the big, beautiful bill. It is big, and I'm not quite sure it's beautiful yet.
Murkowski talks with NPR's Juana Summers about her work on Capitol Hill and her new memoir. Today on All Things Considered, listen where you are on your phone, your laptop, or your radio. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Suppone Ana Luisa Se a guarda cochila eu posso penetrar no castelo e galgar a muralha de onde se divisa o vale, os prados, os matos, os montes, as flores, as fontes, Luísa. Ana Eu fiz esta canção pra você.